Hey everyone, welcome back to the M&M Hockey Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Alex Metzger. Along with me is my co-host, Chase McCallum. And today we are going to be breaking down some of the news from the past week or so, week and a half. And we also later in the episode have Jesse Marshall of The Athletic joining us to talk about everything that has happened with the Pittsburgh Penguins this week. So stay tuned for that at the end of this. It'll be about 20, 30 minutes probably. But we have other stuff to talk about as well to start here. And mainly a lot of Columbus Blue Jackets stuff, which it feels like they're in the news more and more lately. But there was a lot that went on this week. And so we'll start with maybe the lightest thing, but maybe the most surprising to me out of all three things, honestly. And that's Miku Koivu retiring. He decides to hang it up his first year in Columbus. He's only played 7 of 14 games this year. And honestly, he hasn't looked very good. It's one of those things where I think a lot of people looked and said, oh, look how big of a shit show Columbus is that even Koivu's wanting to retire. But in his presser, he even cited him just not having it. And just about anything would back that up so far this year. He really has not been a strong player. And so, yeah, he hangs up the career after his first year away from Minnesota. He played 1,035 games and 1,028 of those came with Minnesota plus 59 more in the playoffs. Overall, pretty good career, you know, 711 points and probably a pretty underrated player just given the market he played in and the style of play that he played during his career.
Yeah, anytime somebody's a defensive specialist on the Minnesota Wild, like that's the perfect kind of player for us stats nerd to be like, this guy was grossly underrated throughout his entire career. Yeah, it's kind of nice to see him hang it up when he's like, I'm done after 10 games or 5 games or whatever it was, instead of like trying to just drag through a season where he just clearly doesn't have it. Because I always find it so sad when guys who were once like really, really good just clearly don't have it anymore, but they can't let go.
Yeah, exactly. And instead of limping through the season and, you know, playing 25 games out of 56 because you're getting healthy for the rest of them and just not producing anything while you're there. You know, it's a shame, but it is what it is. But yeah, you know, in his peak, he was a 50-ish point guy. You know, he had a 71-point season, a 67-point season, a 62-point season, and then 56, 58. So 50-ish, and then a couple 47s and stuff like that as well. But he was really, really good when it came to possession and defensive play. You know, he fit that Minnesota Wild mold perfectly of not letting anything up defensively. And that's kind of what, you know, he'll go down as. And it's unfortunate because some people probably won't remember it quite the same as, you know, maybe stats will, but as stats to start to take a bigger role here, I think that people will, he'll be one of the players that people look back on in a number of years and go, holy crap, like this guy was really good.
Yeah, exactly. He's like the perfect kind of player that you can, once you start diving deeper into hockey, like beyond just offensive statistics, and be like, wow, this guy was a really, really effective player, even though his point totals were all right, too, like you said, but he's even more effective than those, like, 60-point years implied.
Yeah, exactly, and he hasn't had a lot of the 60-point years in a couple of seasons now, right? But he was still an effective player even 4 or 5 years – or 3 or 4 years ago, and, you know, he kind of dropped off quickly. Like, 16-17, he was having 58-point season, 17-18, a 45-point season, 18-19, a 29, then 21, and he had 2 points in 7 games this year. So it's unfortunate to see, but it happens. You know, he's 37 years old. Like, that's kind of what you expect from guys this age, and it's why when you see people like – even like Zdeno Chara or whatever define the age curve so heavily, it's why you need to take it with a grain of salt, because it's like, yeah, not everyone does this, you know, like, and I'm sure there was probably a role for him to be a 12th forward on a team, gain some confidence back and get closer to 50% and, you know, expected goals or whatever. But there is also something to, you know, not having to do that when you were once considered one of the best players in your franchise's history. Right. So.
Yeah, exactly.
Other than that, with Koivu, you know, congrats on a great career, obviously, but you know, I don't have much more to say on that. But let's get into the why I think it was more just, you know, him not having it, and that's fair. But everyone, well, not everyone, but a bunch of people right away kind of went, oh, lol, Tortorella, and because the situation that happened this week, Patrick Laine has already been benched. It took 4 games, and he had 3 goals in those 4 games, and he got benched. I'm not surprised by this. Some people were shocked it took this. It's like, oh, like I was a little surprised maybe it was this early, but I also just wasn't that shocked in general, right? Like, this is what Torts loves to do. You got to quote unquote show them how to play or whatever, you know. And I don't know. I think it's one of those things where you go back and forth. I think we've discussed it on here too. It's like, it's great that Tortorella knows how to get 120% out of a bunch of third liners, but if you're only going to get 60% out of your first liners who want to leave at the end of the year, it probably doesn't actually end up being that good of a job, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And like, on the one hand, stereotypes based on like past information can be bad, but on the other, it really is the least surprising thing in the world that like Tortorella ended up having a problem with this really flashy but defensive cancer style player within like five games.
Yeah, and I guess the reason was Aaron Portsline came out and got the scoop about apparently Line A said something to an assistant coach, and that's why he got benched for the game. And just, I don't know. Like, I don't want to, you know, we've never really been there, but I feel like that's a pretty pathetic reason to bench someone for a game and a half, you know, or like half the game. And it's just like, it's one of those things. The thing that makes me the most mad is, you know, that Tortorella loves being the center of attention. He loves it. But he comes out after the game and goes, oh, I don't like benching guys, but I will. Like, you think this is what I want to do? It's like, yes, you've benched every player on this team. Cam Atkinson came out and said as much. He's like, oh, yeah, everyone's been there. It's like, if you didn't like benching guys, you'd find alternate ways around it not to bench guys for the entirety of a game, you know?
Yeah, and like, I don't say this lightly, but like, you hear John Tortorella quotes almost, if not more often than like you hear about Sheldon Keefe in the news. And that should tell you how aggressive, like, he may say that he doesn't like being the center of attention, but wow, does he seem to find himself in the middle of things all the goddamn time, which makes me assume that, yeah, he actually definitely does love it.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, he just, or he knows exactly how to play into it. You know, maybe it's not like what he strives for every single time, but you can definitely tell he's not afraid to go against the center of attention. And I don't know, like, I get you got to coach your way or whatever, but again, at the same time, like, I just, the guy's got 3 goals in 4 games. And if he said something that was disrespectful, sit him down for a shift or two, a period, whatever. But, you know, the guy, Lining played, I think it was 7 minutes, then 4 minutes, then 0 minutes, you know? So it was pretty much he played 11 minutes and then got sat or whatever. And it's just like, that doesn't feel like the right way to approach, especially people, you know, in this day and age. I mean, we're two people that are around Lining's age, you know, a couple years younger than him, I believe. I think he's, what, 23, 24? He's 22. Yeah. So he's like, yeah, he's literally our age. It's like, just yelling at guys and benching them is not a great way to get through to a ton of people our age these days. You know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly. And like, it makes intuitive sense. Like, if you make somebody hate going to work, they're probably not going to work as well. Like, you can cry about like this generation being snowflakes or whatever, but like, there really is something too, like, you should probably enjoy going to work if you're going to work your best.
Yeah, exactly. And like, again, we're not behind the bench, you know, lots of guys love playing for Tortorella, and you know, a lot of his former players say, yeah, he's hard on people, but then when you do something right, he also gives you the credit or whatever too, which is, it's fair enough. But it's the same thing with just like, you think 3 days or 4 days in, you wouldn't want to you know, be benching your star player that you just got in a trade for another guy who was a star player and wanted out because you were, you know, half the rumors were that you were way too hard on him. So I don't know. Like, it's just one of those things where I'm not shocked that it happened at all. I thought maybe it would be a little bit later. Like, I was a little surprised it was just this immediate, but at the same time, like, if you would have told me when the trade happened, yeah, Lining's going to have 3 goals in 4 games and then get benched in the 4th game, it's like, yeah, okay, you know what? And that doesn't even shock me, you know? Like, seems like a Torts thing to do.
Yep, it's the least surprising thing in the world that this turned out to be a dramatic event.
Yeah, so, I don't know. Like, it's one of those things where, whatever, like, what can you do, right? But, I don't know. It'll be interesting to monitor going forward if, you know, see how Line A rebounds and whatever. But, I don't know what to say, really. Like, it's one of those things where if Line A leaves at the end of this year or say next year or whatever, like, if he leaves the first chance he can get, pretty much, right? Whether that be through RFA this year or UFA whenever he becomes, in a couple of years when he becomes it, you really got to sit down and look and start going, is it worth to have Tortorella, the coach of our team, you know?
Yeah, it certainly begs the question, because obviously head coaches are very influential figures in the organization, but like, you don't get that many cracks at Patrick Laine level players.
No, you really don't. And I mean, you get enough cracks at Pierre-Luc Dubois level players, but even that, just pissing them off. Same with, you know, like Panarin wanted to leave, Bobrovsky left, Duchesne left. And like, I get, you know, it's not that there's different reasons for all of it, but it's also at the same time, like, all when you have, how many guys does it need to become for it to be a trend, right? Like where it's five or six people in the span of 2 years that are like, yeah, we kind of want out of here. We don't really actually like enjoy playing here. You know, I don't know what else to say. Like at some point you have to look internally and go, okay, yes, I get that Columbus isn't a very good destination anyways, but having a pain in the ass coach for star players doesn't seem like the way to improve that.
Yeah, exactly. When you already have difficulties attracting people because it's not exactly the flashiest market in the world, you probably don't need to compound those errors.
Yes, exactly. So the third thing with Columbus was just the one of the last absolute most ridiculous things I've ever seen. So I'm going to try and explain it as best as I can. I wasn't watching the game and I tried to piece it together. But basically, the Islanders were playing, I believe it was the Hurricane, or sorry, the Islanders, the Blue Jackets, I believe, were playing the Hurricanes, maybe? Let me check. It was on Saturday and goal gets scored. Yeah, it was Carolina Hurricanes on Sunday, sorry, I believe, because it was before the Super Bowl. And a goal gets scored and the Blue Jackets challenge for offside. So they're going to their offside review. And I guess so what happens is there's the officials on the ice looking at it, right? And they're connected with a war room in Toronto. But then there's a guy in the middle that's in the rink just connecting the two of them together to make sure nothing happens. And I guess this guy was brand new and like an intern. And I don't know if he didn't realize his mic was off, but he just gave his personal opinion and said, oh yeah, that's a good goal. So the ref said, all right, thanks. They hear that, put their headset down, skate away and call a good goal, right? So then because Columbus challenged and they got it wrong, they now have a 2-minute delay of game penalty. So they're like, by all accounts, hockey ops just screaming to try and get them on the phone. And normally it wouldn't have been too big of an issue because the guys using a headset would have their headsets on, right? And they would just honk it down or like buzz it down and then get the refs to come back before play started. However, because of COVID protocols, you need to wipe the headset down between each use. So the guys, when they get off, all the headsets go in, they wipe them all down with Lysol and everything. And while they're doing that, that's the reason they can't hear the call come back. So they call a good goal, drop puck, start playing again. There's about 50 seconds left in the period. Well, in the intermission, they then call the refs back and say, we screwed up here. It was obviously offside, but we can't take the goal back. So take the penalty off the board. Which is just pure insanity to me. So they take the penalty off the board, which there is no precedent of being able to do it, but they don't take the goal off the board because the puck has already dropped. And this is just insane. I'm surprised Tortorella didn't blow a gasket over this one. That would have been fair enough. But it's just, I don't care. I want your thoughts on it because I have just so many thoughts that, like, how can this happen? And also what they probably should have been doing.
Yeah, it's one of those things where, like I wouldn't be that shocked if this happened in, like, a minor midget AE game or something where the refs are, like, just by the seat of their pants, let's just change this because we can't do this. But it's kind of, like, amazing that something like this happened at the NHL level.
Yeah, like, it's and the fact that they don't – okay, so my biggest issue is it happens. Mistakes happen, right? Like – It was an intern or whatever that screwed up, new on the job, and yeah, whatever. Like, it's silly, but at the same time, like, you're bound to see it once in a while. What the stupidest part to me is them taking the penalty off the board and not the goal. In my opinion, neither should happen. It's like, you know, the rules in football, right? If there's a penalty, you can challenge up until that play is snapped. As soon as the ball is snapped, you're no longer allowed challenging the previous play because it's already gone on. That is exactly what should have happened in this, where the goal stands, but the penalty also stands. Yes, Columbus gets screwed by it, but what do you want them to do? Like, it's got to stand. They screwed up, you know? And I was listening to Puck Soup, and Sean McIndoe, is that his last name? Down goes Brown. He was saying, you know, what they really should have done is just gone to the rest of the intermission, said, the first time a Carolina Hurricane player breathes on a Columbus Blue Jackets player, call a penalty, even it up, because that's what happens in the NHL anyways. Why would you not just do that now? But instead, they decide to take the penalty off the board, but not the goal. And it's like, you can't just half measure it like that. That is the stupidest thing I've ever heard of.
Yeah, that was, like I said, it's amazing that this happened at the NHL level.
Yeah, like it just, and then, you know, they come out and they say, well, the reason we can't take the goal off the board is because there was no precedent for taking the goal off the board. It's like, well, there was none for taking him. There's no rule in the rule book that says you can take a penalty off the board for just no reason at all either, right? Like there's literally just no rule about that. So there's no precedent for any of it. You know, like if you're going to change it for the penalty, how can you not change it for the goal? And I get not wanting to change the goal, but then you can't change either of them. It's got to be both or neither. That simple.
Yeah, like pick one or the other. There's no, you can't be pulling like half measures here.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know. It's just a Mickey Mouse league sometimes. And it's just, it's not shocking, right? Like that this happened in the NHL, of course, but I don't know. Like, it's just one of those things where it's like, how do you let this happen to the point where it's like, okay, one mistake happens. Sure. Another mistake happens. Okay. And then you go, oh yeah, but also, you know, let's just compound it a third time and make an absolute, another mistake that just absolutely did not need to happen.
Yeah. For no apparent reason.
Yeah. And then I love how they, you know, their damage control for all of this is, oh, you know who the league will love to hear for the voice of this reason? Colin Campbell. As if, you know, you couldn't have chose any worse other than maybe Gary Bettman to come out and try and explain why you did what you did here. But I don't know. That was one thing I wanted to bring up. Just an absolute mess over the weekend. And it was just very fitting considering everything else that has happened with the Columbus Blue Jackets this week, you know?
Yeah, it's almost magical that it just keeps compact. Like, I don't know if there's ever been a news cycle so heavily centered around the Columbus Blue Jackets.
No, I don't think so. Not around Columbus. I mean, I would be shocked anyways.
Yeah, but, me too.
Other than that, we don't have a ton of news, but I did want to break down some other small things. One of the things I wanted to touch on was the Toronto Maple Leafs and their start in the North Division. They really have a stranglehold on this North Division as recording. This should be out Saturday at some point. We're recording Friday afternoon and then evening. Everyone has played at least 14 games other than Calgary. Toronto is sitting at top of the standings with 23 points right now. The next closest team is Montreal with 18 and the same amount of games played. You know, Toronto and Montreal play on Saturday. And if Toronto wins that, they go 7 points ahead of the next place team with a game in hand on the Oilers still and the same amount of games played against Montreal. They really have the capability to just dominate this division, like, you know, some projection models kind of had them doing.
Yeah, and it's one of those things too where like 8-point leads were insurmountable at the best of times during an 82 game season. Like if they can get like an 8 or a 10-point lead 15 games in, like with all the loser points in the NHL, that's just going to be so hard for any team to come back from unless Toronto just completely like implodes.
But yeah, like, you would need Toronto to probably play 500 hockey and Edmonton or Montreal to go on an absolute heater for it to be close at the top of the division if they have a 10-point lead at the 17-game mark of the season or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. Because like we said, like it's people talk about how like early points matter so much that by I think it's like Thanksgiving, you can guess like 75% of the playoff teams based on who's in right now. And like that's just going to be even more extreme this year.
Oh, absolutely. It always is in shortened seasons. But the one thing I really wanted to bring up was your opinion on how they're winning, because they aren't playing their best hockey we've ever seen them play. You've had a couple pieces about, are the Toronto Maple Leafs actually inconsistent? You took a look and it was like, yes, they actually are. They get blown out a lot or just, you know, destroyed more often than any other team. And, you know, this year they're finding ways to stay in games. And I'm wondering, a lot of the narrative of them right now, so if anyone's wondering, they're ranked 16th in Corsi 4 percentage, and they're below 50% in expected goals, which sits just a tad, but it sits them at 19th. If you score adjust that, because, you know, teams like Ottawa are ahead of them in Corsi 4 percentage, which just isn't right, because Ottawa trails 90% of their games. But, you know, score adjusted, Toronto's up to 11th in Corsi 4 percentage and expected goals up to 51%, which puts them at 15th. So still pretty average metrics, all things considered. Is this a good thing that we're seeing out of the Toronto Maple Leafs, or are they lucky? You know, I think it's fair to say they're 8-1-1 in their last 10. So there's obviously an extent to luck. No team does that over and over again. But are you encouraged by what you're seeing with the Toronto Maple Leafs right now, or would you rather see them play better? Because a big part of the narrative is they're finding ways to win with their quote unquote B game. When the skill's not going, they're finding ways to quote grind games out. And I buy into that a little bit, but I want to know how much you buy into it and whether it's something to be keep an eye on, or, you know, are they just extremely lucky?
Yeah, I'm like, so obviously anytime you go 8-1, like you said, there's an extreme amount of luck there. And like, so their RAPM numbers look a lot better than their raw numbers, but like with the collinearity of like the divisions only having seven teams and you're not playing outside your divisions, that's so hard to put stock into. So I'm healthily skeptical. Like they haven't looked bad, but they haven't looked really good either outside of like Matthews is just killing it. And Justin Hall has been like this huge bright spot, but like there isn't like, it's not a super rosy picture to me in spite of their record.
Yeah. And I think, again, I think you could even look at that two ways too, where you can take a positive out of that and say, this team's 11-2-1 top of the East or top of the North division by a mile. And you can argue that two or three of their best players haven't even looked as good as they probably should. Right. Now you can also say that they're 11-2-1 and this is due to come back because they're good players unless they step up, you know, like they need to step up for them to continue success. And I think it's a little bit of both where it's like, I feel like we're two or three games away or two or three bounces in games away where the Leafs are actually 9-4-2 instead of 8-4-2 and tied with the Canadians in points for their record. And it's instead of the narrative being they're finding ways to win with their B game, they look a lot more gritty this year. It's this is the same old team that should be dominating everyone, but they're not. And I don't know. I feel like that is just kind of an error on, you know, mainstream media anyways. Like it's kind of really dictatorial, but like if you win close games by one or two goals, you're suddenly dubbed this good defensive team who knows how to shut it down and play a grinding like game. Whereas if those bounces just don't go your way, you're this young, inexperienced team that just can't seem to get it done.
Yeah. And it's such like hindsight bias that basically, if you're lucky, you're good. And if you're unlucky, you're bad is what it comes down to in a lot of media.
Yes, absolutely. And so I don't know. I'm interested to see where Toronto goes. Like I do buy into the fact that like there have been some nights, because I think your data would show the same, where if Toronto's skill wasn't going, they would just get destroyed some nights. You know, like it's not like it would be a 3-2 game they lose. It's like a 6-7-1 game. But that's not what people point to. If people are pointing to that, you know, I would understand it more. It's not like Toronto's getting absolutely blown out when they lose these nights anymore, right? It's like they lost to Ottawa, I think, and was it Edmonton maybe once as well? But it's like they were all relatively close games from what I remember. So I do buy into that a little bit, that it's like, yes, if, you know, Matthews isn't scoring two and Marner/Tavares aren't potting some as well, it's not like they're absolutely dead in the water losing 6-2 or whatever. But still, at some point, it's like you can't just say that they're this great team that grinds the game out because they've just won 9 1-goal games or whatever, right?
Yeah, exactly. Like that's just not going to sustain itself over a long period of time. Now, like you said, so the flip side to everything I wrote about them being super inconsistent and getting blown out way more often than any other team of their quality does is they dominated teams even more often than like the Tampa Bay Lightning and the Vegas Golden Knights did. But like they're not really doing that all that much either, and like except for like Canucks games. But so like there's a give and a get here going on here. And yeah, I think giving up the dominating games is not worth like subtracting from the blowout losses.
Yeah. I mean, and it's fair. Like their goal differential, because it feels like they've won a ton of 1-goal games, and they kind of have, but their goal differential is still second best in the league. And I get that's not the end all be all or anything like that. But, you know, sometimes you see a team that's in the playoffs with like a negative goal differential or whatever. And it's just like, okay, well, that's clearly not sustainable. But at the same time, I also think that, you know, this division's a little more flawed, because you look at the goal differential, 5 of the 7 teams have positive goal differential. And then you have Ottawa sitting at a league worst minus 31 and Vancouver at a minus 15. The next worst in the league, by the way, is Detroit at minus 20. So you have Ottawa that's 11 goals worse than any team. But I mean, it's not even like Toronto's played Ottawa all that much either. So I don't know. It's one thing I want to bring up, because especially last night, I think, or the other night, the narrative coming out of that Montreal game was insane to me. I thought they got dominated by Montreal for the first, 40 minutes or so. And then they really kind of woke up in the last period and potted 3 on Price. But the report, like the narrative coming out of that in Toronto media was, oh, this is amazing, because they finally found a way to just kind of weather the storm. They clearly weren't all that worried about it. And it was actually good the way they played through the second period. It's like, I don't think, you know, only having 30% of the shots or shot attempts in the second period is actually a good thing to be having.
Yeah, it's definitely not. And like, so there is something with Toronto where, especially relative to the Canadian division teams, like if Toronto is the 10th best play driving team in the league, they can still easily be like the 5th cup favorites or whatever, because they have so much shooting talent. But like, when you're just getting killed, like, you can't say, well, this is actually fine, because we're still finding ways to win. Like, in the long run, even with all the shooting talent, you're still going to lose if you're getting filled in.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, so that's why, like, I wouldn't be too worried about their, because, you know, like, score adjusted, which I think you kind of need to do at this point, they are like, you know, what I say was 15th or whatever in expected goals. It's not like they're a bad team. Yeah, they're 15th, and I think they're 11th in Corsi 4. So, you know, that shooting talent probably takes you, they have so much of it too, where if they finish, say, 8th and 12th in the league or whatever in those two metrics, it's like, well, that shooting talent probably bumps you up a couple spots as well, because especially when expected goals at the top of the league, it's Carolina, Montreal, Boston, Minnesota, Colorado, Florida, Calgary, Vegas, Tampa, Arizona. So of those teams, Montreal's looked better this year, but I'm still not sold that they have just boatloads of shooting talent on their team, right? Minnesota, we know, doesn't have boatloads of shooting talent on their team other than Kaprizov and Fiala, maybe. Florida has some guys, but it's not like they're just like, Carter Verhaeghe is just absolutely going off this year. I don't expect him to just keep shooting at insane clip or anything like that. And then the Coyotes don't either. So you look at the top teams, and you can argue Carolina lacks it a little bit too, although they do have guys like Svechnikov, obviously. But you could argue that probably in the top 10, 4 teams really don't have shooting talent, and then Toronto's got better shooting talent than probably 3 of the other teams easily as well. So it's not something to be super worried about. But yeah, it's weird to me how the narrative changes when you know, the expected goals and Corsi 4 in a period are 70-30 in terms of percentage. And people go, no, that was actually a good, gritty defensive period. It's like, well, it really wasn't, you know?
Yeah, and I will say, part of the reason why I'm not like super concerned is because by the end of the season, John Tavares, William Nylander, and Mitch Marner will have way better numbers at 5-on-5 than they do now. And I think that'll be like the rising tide that lifts the team up into being that more dominant play driving team that they should be. But like, descriptively, it is a little concerning.
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, if it doesn't continue, but you know, I think I would look at it, if I'm a Leafs fan, as a little more positive, where you're winning these games despite your guys not dominating at 5-on-5, and we have a large history showing that they do control play at 5-on-5, so you would expect that to bounce back. But yeah, that was the other thing I want to bring up. We're hitting about the 30-minute mark now, so we will flip it over to our interview with Jesse Marshall. Thank you, everyone, for listening. Joining us now, he's covering all things Pittsburgh Penguins for The Athletic Pittsburgh. It's Jesse Marshall. Jesse, thank you so much for joining us today. How's it going, man?
Hanging in there, guys. Appreciate it. It's been a pretty boring week. Nothing's been going on.
No, there's been nothing to talk about at all. You know, we were like, oh, what are we even going to discuss if we have you on this week? For anyone who doesn't know, I would assume you probably would by now, but the Pittsburgh Penguins have been the center of the media this week. You know, them and the Columbus Blue Jackets, obviously, but Pittsburgh made a splash or a couple hirings here this week with Hextall and Burke as well. And, you know, this came, I feel like we knew they were probably going to hire someone eventually, correct? But I was a little not surprised at the timing, but it developed pretty quick over the week. And, you know, Rutherford had, stepped out a month ago or so now. And then in comes Hextall and Burke this week. Can you explain just how quickly things seem to develop in the couple days there?
I actually think that it was an ongoing, I think it was actually more slow moving than people probably realized. I mean, you mentioned the part about, it was almost a month really since they filled the position. And I mean, I guess, in that sense, like Patrick Alvin, who was the interim general manager, had never had the job before, but is an extremely competent individual that everybody had a lot of faith in to steer the ship, in the interim. But I think actually, the process of getting people in and doing the interviews and, just some of the, I guess, finer points actually probably, I think, drug out a little bit longer than some people thought. And once we kind of had found out that the process was underway, it certainly seemed like they took their time with it. And then we kind of found out after the fact, that Brian Burke was kind of in the background, I guess you could say, as an advisor to the process the entire time, which wasn't something I think we were initially aware of. It makes sense because the Penguins had tried to bring in Dale Tallon last year to do, basically the same job and build out, on a hockey operations department. So, I think when the dust settled, you had Ron Hextall in the mix. Kevin Weeks got more than one interview. I think Mike Fuda got more than one interview. But at the end of the day, I think Hextall was kind of the guy they had their eye on from more or less the onset of the process. They successfully got him in. I think they feel really confident about it. And to boot, they bring, Burke in with him to, kind of focus on the operations side and help them to establish, I guess you could say, a foothold in that area.
Yeah, and I think, Hextall, maybe at least to me, wasn't quite as surprising. Burke was a little bit just not out of left field, but kind of just because of where he was working. He was with Sportsnet, he was doing daily hits with them on TV, and it kind of felt like they were almost grooming him to step up into that big next role, and he came out. I know he was on radio here in Toronto, 1050, TSN 1050, and he was saying that, just as you said, he was helping through the hiring process, where he was, when people asked if they, he had information on candidates, he would give his opinion and everything. And that's kind of how the position offer developed. But I was personally a little surprised when Brian Burke was named president of hockey operations. I'm wondering what you see. Do you think this will be a good fit with these two? Like, would you rather see someone else, or how do you think these two are going to work together? And do you think this is the ideal situation for the Penguins?
Well, I think we have to start with a sort of an assessment of the environment, guys, right? So the Penguins don't really have a hockey operations department, right? That's like, people will hear this and they'll say like, what? Not the Penguins, but really, that's true. Like, David Morehouse, the president of the team, has kind of de facto been involved with that. Much, I think, to the chagrin of Penguins fans. I think that, there are established roles in the front office, right? Like Patrick Alvin was the director of scouting, and Sam Ventura was the director of analytics and had a role in hockey operations as well. But, was there silos? Like, did people understand where they fit in the greater good? I think that there were some things that were perhaps left behind from Jason Karmanos when he left that didn't get picked up by other people, which is like a, that I think, noting the environment, right? Noting that situation, it makes sense as to why Brian Burke got brought in. Because if you're really looking for somebody to build that, and you need somebody that could put together a competent, fully functional hockey operations department, there's probably not anybody better in the business based on his connections, his functional understanding of how a franchise works, his success with building them in the past. That's probably, and then, I think they probably would have felt the same way about Dale Tallon, right? Like, his ability to build out a front office is, he can do it. He's well documented. And I think they felt that they needed it. I don't think that their paths are going to cross all that much, to be honest with you. Being as though, as noting that Burke was an advisor to this process, I can't envision a scenario where, you know, he's toe stepping on the guy that he hired, right? I think his work will be more administrative and getting the front of the house in order.
Yeah, I think that's definitely fair. And I think, you know, in my opinion here, it's good that Burke is the president of hockey ops, because as you said, you know, he can do that job really well. He's shown it. I would be a little more intrigued, but also maybe, I don't know if worried's the right word, but curious to see what kind of direction they go in if he was the GM, just, you know, some of his quotes and everything. But I still think that applies too. But I also like the Hextall hiring in terms of a GM. You know, he gets a lot of credit right now for that, the team that is in Philly, because he laid the foundation of it. But what I'm curious about is, you know, in Philly, he took his time. He's known to be a pretty patient GM. He didn't want to bring up Carter Hart or anything like that right away if he didn't have to. With this Penguins team, it's a little different, because we've already, obviously, one of the most quoted tweets this week was Brian Burke a month ago or so discussing about, you know, or I think it was a month or two ago on Sportsnet, saying how if he was Jim Rutherford, he thinks they have to kind of rebuild it and tear it down. But, you know, now he's kind of in a win mode now with the team. I want to get your opinion on what you think Hextall can do with this team now. And do you think it's going to be a bit of a slow build and they're going to try and run with this core for a year or two, or do you think we're going to see some big changes in the near future for the Pittsburgh Penguins?
I think the initial inclination is to attempt to build this current iteration of the team in a way that can win the Stanley Cup now. I would assume that probably is also true in the short term next year. You know, I don't know what it means for the coaching staff. I don't know, you know, if they're a part of a plan that even extends in the short term. And I think they'll probably take a look at that as we go. But it seems like they feel like there's still compatibility in this window. It's still open, and that there's still things that can be done to, you know, kind of get back to the, you know, ultimate goal. So I think the challenge for Ron Hextall is to find a way to do that without sacrificing any of your three good prospects. And there really are just kind of three, right? I mean,
it's a little dry.
Honest, it's, yeah, it's, and it's not like you're not swimming in prospects over here. This is in Ottawa. And then on the top of that, save the picks too. Because the cupboard's bare. We already mentioned that. They don't have a first round pick this year because of the Jason Zucker trade. You know, Ron Hextall is a guy who's made good with late rounders. You know, he's maximized the value, so to speak, I guess, out of all of the picks that he's had. So that's encouraging, right? I don't know that Ron Hextall has the knack for it that Mike Fuda does. But perhaps the Penguins valued Hextall's sort of like overarching GM experience over Fuda's, right? That would be understandable. So either way, I mean, I think the Penguins have a guy who's proven that from a scouting perspective, you know, they can go out and get talent and not just the ones that the obvious talent that falls into their lap either. You know, we're talking, you know, late round talent that can, you know, give you good hockey on a cheap contract for a decent period of time.
Yeah, and that's kind of what they need right now too, right? Chase is, I should let Chase chip in here too. I don't know if there's any thoughts here from you, Chase.
Yeah, so you kind of mentioned this a little bit, but what does a Penguins team that can win right now look like to you? Like, do you think it's that much different than this current team?
So, Chase, that's a good question, and no, because right now, most of the issues that they're running into are entirely self-inflicted. I would say, you know, functionally speaking, from like your four lines and your 6D, you know, your 6D, you're okay. Goaltending is terrifying right now. Yeah. Because Tristan Jarry just is not anywhere near the all-star version of himself from less than a year ago, right? That's bad. Casey DeSmith, you know, last night had it was a real battle. Stuck in it all night long in some difficult circumstances at times. Got 2 points out of it. But it's, you know, no disrespect, it's Casey DeSmith, right? You didn't expect him to have to step in and play 45 games this year, right? So that I think that's probably where they look first. And they have, you know, they have Emil Army in the American Hockey League, who's just not ready yet, in my opinion. You know, I mean, maybe I'm wrong, you know, maybe everybody's wrong, and you know, he gives you a little something that's level. I just think that he's a little too raw. So it's a position that would have to be addressed externally. And unfortunately, like, look right now at Minnesota, right? Like, they have no goaltenders. San Jose, like, just lost Devan Dubnyk. Like, there are, it just seems like every team in the league almost has got some manner of goaltending problem right now, whether it's their backup, their starter, or both. So this is not something that's, like, easily fixed. You know, you can't, it's, you're not just, like, walking down to the Sunoco and picking up, like, a candy bar, you know? So I think that's it. But to your point, though, like, defensively, like, there have been surprising performances all year long from Cody Ceci or Chad Ruedel or, you know, Marcus Pedersen and Juuso Riikola before they got hurt. I think we're both turning in good performances. Now, like, Dumoulin, Letang, Marino, these are guys that have kind of, like, been playing with their heads screwed on, you know, the wrong way almost sometimes. Your top six is dominated long stretches of hockey and really hadn't earned the goals from it. That's a luck thing, right? That's shooting percentage. Not a whole lot really that you could do about that. Maybe you want more depth and maybe a little more scoring touch in the bottom six. I get that. But I think the point is that it's really not that far off. This is, I feel anyway, more directional in the sense that it's, you know, it's 50 good minutes ruined by 10 of just really bad hockey. And that solving that is probably the difference between where they are now and where they want to be.
I think that's, yeah, I mean, that's really fair. And I think if people aren't sure about how poor the goaltending has been, if you want to, even their raw save percentage, I think, is the worst in the league among duos. If not, it's second worst. But their goal saved above average and above expected is atrocious this year. The bottom five goalies or four goalies right now in the league are Marcus Hogberg, Martin Jones, Tristan Jarry, Matt Murray, and then Casey DeSmith is down at the 12th worst out of 50 or 62 goalies, sorry, that have played in at least 50 minutes this year. So it's been, you know, it doesn't really matter to an extent how well you play if you literally or you physically cannot get a save, right? And that'll be, it's so interesting to see how teams try and get past that because, you know, you mentioned how many teams are dealing with goaltending struggles. Just look at some of the guys that have been claimed off waivers this year. Like it's been people that I think, like, I barely know, and I try and stay as informed around the hockey, like, as you possibly can, right? And it's just random names that are like,
right. Oh, I can't even remember who it is now up in Chicago.
Yeah, it's like a 23-year-old, is it?
Yeah, I can't even remember his last name. It begins with
not Lekkonen, but it's something like
something
that.
Yeah,
exactly. Like, that's who ended up taking the starting job right now because he kind of had to and he's run with it. It's Kevin Lankinen, sorry, not Lekkonen. But yeah, the 25-year-old who's trying to run with the starting job, he's doing a great job of it. But, like, that's just kind of the scenario we're in, right? And you saw, sorry about that if you guys heard that. You see the Edmonton Oilers, like, they were claiming just guys. It was like, who is this guy off of waivers? About a month ago when the season started. So that's definitely, I think, going to be the biggest area of need. And, you know, maybe you hope it regresses a little bit to the point where it's just, if you know, obviously you can't win with league worst goaltending, but hopefully you can get closer to average goaltending and balance things out. Because then, as you said, I think that they have, obviously, when you have Crosby and Malkin up front, Letang on your blue line, you have the pieces in place to kind of go for it, but it's going to be, you know, what are those little moves that you can make to improve your team?
One of the things that you said is really important in all this, and it's, you know, save, you know, percentage versus expectation. Because I think, like, the common refrain from people, you know, when trying to evaluate the situation as well, first of all, it's very volatile. You know, the team's not great defensively. They have these meltdowns, and that's all true, right? But we have, you know, methodology for, you know, evaluating players, like, in the midst of that, right? And accounting for those circumstances. So if you take them into consideration, even taking them into consideration, I mean, the level is still, you know, as you mentioned, behind, I think, probably by, like, over a goal and a half now, maybe close to two goals. You know, two goals is, you know, you're starting to get creeping towards, it's adding up the points in the standing. So, yeah, it's dire. And there's, you know, they addressed it in a major, when you know, it's, I think organizationally dire in the sense that going into this year, I mean, they made, you know, they have limited capital to spend at the draft and invested, you know, half of what they had in goaltending. So it's just not just like a parent problem. This is something that extends well beyond that into, you know, into the farm system as well.
Yeah, for sure. And I think, you know, it's a problem that kind of extends into next year too, because already their projected cap hit for this next season is $79 million, which is a pure $3 million less than this year. And, you know, they don't have to re-sign too many people. You know, Cody Ceci's a UFA. Then you have your only RFAs are Zach Aston-Reese, Teddy Bluger, who I would assume they'll get a little bit of a raise, but it shouldn't be, you know, unbearable or anything like that. But it, more importantly, it's just more where do you find the money to try and